Good evening, everyone. Is the mic on? Okay. Mic check. Mr. Schultz?
Just talk a little louder, that's all.
Ah, okay. Spoken like a true ex-Marine.
I'm not an ex-Marine. I'm a Marine. No what? Such thing as an ex-Marine.
Once a Marine, always a Marine. Well, welcome, everyone, to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. So wonderful to see a full house here. It's interesting. I think we're going through a period of time where we've had about 15 sold-out programs for the Commonwealth Club. I think we're all anxious to discuss the issues of the day and particularly appreciative that you're here with us tonight. The club can be found, of course, on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. You can watch videos on YouTube of the club's programs, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. As many of you know, I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club, and I am so pleased and honored to be moderating this evening's program with Secretary Schultz. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers Family Foundation. And there are several members of the Travers family here. Thank you very much. And here. And this is also part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It is my great pleasure to introduce today's special guest, the Honorable George P. Schultz. He is a distinguished fellow at the Hoover Institution, former U.S. Secretary of State, Labor, and Treasury, and I think one of our wisest people in the United States, our wisest statesman. He's also author of the new book, Learning from Experience, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. What experiences he has had. George Schultz is universally acknowledged to be one of the world's preeminent statesmen. While he served as President Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State from 1982 to 89, he played a crucial role in implementing a foreign policy that led to the successful conclusion of the Cold War and the development of strong relationships between the United States, the countries of the Asia-Pacific region, including China, Japan, and the ASEAN countries. He also served during the Nixon administration as Secretary of Labor, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, and Secretary of the Treasury. That is four cabinet-level positions. Since 1989, he's been a distinguished fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's honorary chairman of the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research, also of the MIT Energy Initiative External Advisory Board.
I'm getting tired listening to all this.
And of the Schultz-Stevenson Task Force on Energy Policy. Being a modest person, he's also going to protest when I say that in 1989 he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Today we're going to talk about foreign policy, economics, what makes great presidential leadership, of course, as the new administration's policies begin to take shape. Now please join me in welcoming Secretary Schultz. You begin your book with a story about a professor you had at MIT, and who told the story about when he was appointed to a position, the conversation that went on in his hometown about how he knew everything, but he don't realize nothing. What is the difference between knowledge and realization?
Well, you know something in your head, but you realize something in your gut. And what you realize, you get from your experience. And I think it guides you to a very considerable extent. So that's why the title of my book is Learning from Experience. That teaches you stuff in your gut.
Would you start by telling us a few of the key experiences from which you learned? There are many, many, many in the book, but which experiences were most formative for you?
Well, lots of experiences that went along, but since we're in the Marine Memorial, why don't I tell you some things I learned as a Marine? First of all, I'm in Marine Corps boot camp at the start of World War II. The sergeant hands me my rifle. He says, take good care of this rifle. This is your best friend. And remember one thing. Never point this rifle at anybody unless you're willing to pull the trigger. No empty threats. Big lesson in realization. I told that story to President Reagan once, and he followed up on it. We'd be in the Situation Room, and somebody would say, that's unacceptable. And he'd say, what are you going to do if it happens? The answer is nothing. He said, well, it's not acceptable, and you accepted it. So mean what you say. And when you say you're going to do something, do it. And if you're applying that more broadly, you can say, if you're dealing with somebody and they always do what they say they're going to do, then you trust them. And I think in many dealings, and if you look around, it's so important. Trust is the coin of the realm. If there's somebody you're working with and you trust them, it makes all the difference. So that Marine Corps sergeant taught me a lot. Then I had another experience. I was overseas. We had a little combat. I was fresh to it. And I had a wonderful sergeant named Peyton, who, you know, you get close to people in these situations. He was an extraordinary guy, smart, able, he could do anything, and he and I were great friends. So we had this action going on. I'm looking around for him, and I don't know where he is. I ran over where he might be. I said, where the hell's Peyton? Peyton's dead, sir. I'll never forget it. The reality of war sinks in. Wonderful people get killed, injured, sometimes badly. So if you're ever in a position to have an impact on whether or not we should use force, remember Peyton. Think carefully. Be sure the mission is a good mission. Be sure you equip people to accomplish what it is they set out to accomplish.
I was interested. I learned a lot from your book about your early life and your early experiences. And I didn't know you'd been involved in desegregation efforts. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I, of course, knew that there was discrimination. But I was co-chairman with Clark Kerr of something called the Armor Automation Fund. The meatpacking industry was going through a change. They had always in the past driven animals to Chicago, Fort Worth, Kansas City, these big packing plants. And they suddenly dawned on them that that long trip, the animals lost a lot of weight, which is what they're selling. So they started to have smaller plants out where the animals were. And that was a big rearrangement. So they set up the Armor Automation Fund to help think it through and also deal with the challenges that took place. So they closed a plant in Fort Worth, Texas. And I go down with the team, the management guy, the union guy, me and Arnie Weber, who was working with me. And we decided to go to the hotel before we went to the plant. So I go up to the clerk and I ask for a room, and he gives me a nice suite. And Arnie gets something. Management guy gets a room, no problem. Union guy comes, he's black. And the clerk looks at him and says, we don't have any rooms. And he pulls out a confirmation slip and hands it to him. So he goes into a back room and comes out and he says, we don't have any rooms. By this time, my blood is boiling. And I said, you do have a room. You gave me a suite. Put a cot in the extra room and we'll register him. And he did it. So it turned out that was the first time a black person was registered in that hotel. So I realized, you know, when you're on the moral high ground, stay there and insist. Don't mince words. And sometimes people will do something even if they don't have authority to do it. But then we had an occasion when Armor opened a new plant in a little town called Worthington, Minnesota. They were building the plant, and the little community was very pleased to have the meatpacking jobs. They were good jobs. And all of a sudden, the Armor closes this big plant in Kansas City that had been there for a long time. Most of the workers in it were black. And in their contract, there was a provision that you could bump into another plant if you had enough seniority. So I go to Worthington, and I find it's an all-white community. This is in the mid-60s when we're having riots in our cities. There are no blacks there. So the governor's human rights person comes down and he tells me, please stop this. It's going to be mayhem. But Clark and I talked it over. He said, well, these guys have contractual rights. It's up to us to do what we can to be able to realize them. So I start talking to the town fathers. And they're in the small town. And they start saying, you know, big cities, they don't know anything about people. They're not real people. They're just big numbers. We're a little town. Everybody knows each other in this town. We can get along. Then somebody said, well, we're building a new housing place with this new plant. They can all live there. Town father says, no way. That just creates a black gutter. We don't live out among us. And then the black started sending up little scouting parties. So we helped them get around and meet people. And all of a sudden, the churches realized a lot of these people are tithers. They pledged. And of course, then the churches started to compete for them. I said to Clark, we just turned a corner. And about 200 came up to the plant. It worked, no problem. And it taught me that if you work at it and you talk to people and let people work together a little bit, it helps. So then I'm Secretary of Labor, and the President Nixon decides that it's time to desegregate the schools in the South. In seven southern states, the schools were segregated by law. This is, 60 years after the Brown decision. They're still segregated. So he decides he says it's right constitutionally, it's right morally to desegregate the schools. So that just doesn't happen. You've got to manage it. So he appoints a committee to manage it. Vice President Adnew has made the chairman, and I'm the vice chairman. Pat Moynihan was working in the White House then. He was on it, and a man named Len Garment. And Agnew would have nothing to do with it. He said, I don't want to be associated with this. So I became the chairman. So we talked about it, and we decided to form biracial committees, same number of blacks as whites, in each state. And we checked out with the president, Mr. President, we're not going to pay any attention to the politics of these people. We're only interested in getting strong, respected people. That's all. Now he went along with that. So we got them appointed, and we brought the first one up from Mississippi. Everybody said that'd be the toughest state. We brought them up to the White House, took them into the Roosevelt Room. I learned from my labor experience that you got to let people blow off steam, and if they're arguing about principle, you're never going to get anywhere. So I let them blow off steam. The blacks thought this was a great idea. The whites didn't like it. And after enough of that, I had the Attorney General standing by. He's a very gruff guy named John Mitchell. And the whites thought he was their guy. But anyway, I brought in John. I said, what are you going to do when the schools open, John? He said, I'm the Attorney General. I'm going to enforce the law. Okay, leave. So I said, well, this has been an interesting discussion this morning, but it's not relevant. The schools are going to be desegregated. And the only question is, how's that going to work? Is there going to be violence? What's going to happen to the quality of education and so on? These are problems. And these are your communities. These are your children. So let's talk about it. And, you know, when you give people problems, they can dig in. They can grapple with the problem. So pretty soon they started doing that more and more. And I took them over to the diplomatic reception rooms for lunch. There is the Thomas Jefferson desk that he constructed himself and on which he wrote the Declaration of Independence. It says, all men are created equal. I pointed out that phrase, and I got two guys I lined them up. I thought they would be good co-chairmen. And as they were really getting going, I could see they were going to get somewhere, I left them. And there was a young lawyer from the Justice Department who was very upset with me. Why'd you leave them? You had to go. I said, you don't get it. If I'm there and they come to an agreement, it's my agreement. If I'm not there and they come to agreement, it's their agreement. And it's very important that it's their agreement. They will work harder to make it go. Anyway, they got together and they agreed to be the co-chairman. And we go back to the White House. And by the time the mid-afternoon comes, they're in going well, and I give a signal. We go across the hall into the Oval Office, and the president greets them all, sits them down, and he says, "Here we are in the Oval Office. Think of the things that have been decided here that affected the security and welfare of our country. Well, here we are with this major issue and this major development that's going to take place in our country. I've made my decision. But that's not enough in a democracy like ours. You have to make your decisions and carry them out. And we're here ready to work with you and try to make this work." And there was back and forth. By the time they left the Oval Office, they were on cloud nine and ready to go to work. And it worked state after state. We sort of went the same. So Pat and I decided the last meeting was Louisiana. And we said, well, let's have the meeting down there. And then we'll have it followed by a meeting with all the co-chairmen from the different states that was getting close to school openings. And it'll be a kind of a night of good event. So we go into the Oval Office, and I make my pitch, and the president looks at Agnew. Agnew says, "Mr. President, don't go. There you'll be in a room, and half the people will be white, half the people will be black. There's going to be blood running through the streets of the South. You don't want the blood on your hands." The president looks at me, and I said, "Well, Mr. President, whatever happens, it's on your watch. And you've met these people. They're good people. You made a big impression on them. And they haven't been idle. They've been working. And we've been working with them. And I think you ought to go." So he goes. So Pat and I go down, and it's harder. And all of a sudden it's dawning on me. It's one thing to bring people to the White House. It's another thing to have them meet in the hotel room in their hometown. It's not the same. But we're making a lot of progress, and by the time the president comes, they're almost there, but not quite, and he finishes the job. And then we have the meeting of the co-chairman, and it was like a revival meeting, people exchanging views. "You've thought about this problem, you've thought about that problem, here's what we're going to do," and so on, exchanging views. It was fairly sensational. So we're riding back to Washington on Air Force One, and we're sitting around talking. Bryce Harlow was the only guy with any real Southern background in our group. And the president comes back, and he listens for a while. And then he says to Bryce, "Well, Bryce, how do you think it's going to go?" And Bryce says, "Well, Mr. President, I think it's going to go pretty well in the South. The problem's going to be when it comes north. That's where the problem is." He says, "Why is that, Bryce?" "Well," he says, "in the South, we live together. If they get sick, we take care of them. If we get sick, they take care of us. They do the cooking. They do the laundry. They look after our children. We're, as human beings, we're close together, so it's not going to be a strange thing. In the North, it's just the opposite. They don't live together." So it turned out to be a very prophetic remark, because it did go really well. There was no violence, and it went off well. And from these experiences, one of the things I've learned is that if there's a big problem, talk to people, get people together. Try to define it as a problem. Get them to start talking about how you solve the problem. And then pretty much you can solve it.
Of the many problems that you've been involved in solving, from segregation to ending the Cold War, what are you most proud to have solved?
Well, I think the most thrilling day for me when I was Secretary of State, I worked hard on the issues of Soviet Jewry. I always met with dissidents when I went to Moscow, and President Reagan was very strong on that. But always I met with a woman named Ida Nudel. She had a sister who was out, and met with her too. And I put her on a list where I gave Shevardnadze, and he promised to work on it. And I come back to my office one afternoon, and a phone call comes through. I pick up the phone. "This is Ida Nudel. I'm in Jerusalem. I'm home." It's a thrill to this day. So if you say, what makes you feel it was all worthwhile, it's something human, that some human being is better off because of something that you had a hand in. That's what gets you.
In all of these various roles, what was the most trying moment, the most difficult moment and challenging?
I think the process we went through that created the event that I think was the turning point in the Cold War, the Soviets had deployed intermediate range nuclear weapons. These weapons were designed to hit Europe, Japan, and China, but not us. And the diplomatic ploy was to say, would we risk retaliation with their intercontinental missiles by using our intercontinental missiles to deter use of their intermediate range weapons? That was a diplomatic ploy. So we worked an agreement with NATO that we would try to negotiate a satisfactory outcome with them. And if we couldn't get it, we'd deploy our own intermediate range missiles. And we worked hard at that and did all kinds of things to convince, you know, when you're bargaining, you're not just bargaining with the Soviets, you're bargaining with the European public to convince them that you're doing something that is in their interest and they can trust you. So we came to the end, and it wasn't possible to reach an agreement. So we deployed cruise missiles in Britain, and Margaret Thatcher helped us there. We deployed cruise missiles in Italy, and Andreotti kept us there. And then the big deal was ballistic missiles, nuclear-armed ballistic missiles in Germany. And it was a huge undertaking. The Soviets threatened war. They walked out of the negotiations, put a tremendous amount of heat on. But the alliance basically held firm. It was Helmut Kohl's finest hour, and we got the missiles deployed. So there was this huge thing, and we stood up to it. Over time, as time went on during the year 1984, gradually they subsided. And in August of that year, I was able to go to President Reagan and say, Mr. President, at four different European capitals, a Soviet diplomat has come up to one of ours and said virtually the same thing, which boils down to, if Gromyko, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union, is invited to Washington when he comes to the General Assembly in September, he will accept. In other words, the Soviets blinked. I said, you may want to think this over, because Jimmy Carter canceled these meetings when they went into Afghanistan, and they're still there. President Reagan said, I don't have to think it over. Let's get him here. So we did a little diplomatic minuet, and he came. And there was a little fun part, because Nancy Reagan was a pal. And she always fixed me up with a Hollywood starlet at White House dinners. I got to dance with Ginger Rogers. How good does it get? Made Fred Astaire jealous. But anyway, I went to Nancy and I said, here's what's going to happen, Nancy. He comes to the West Wing. We have a meeting in the Oval Office. Then we all walk down the colonnade to the mansion. That's your home. And we have some stand-around time. And then there's a working lunch. So how about your being there at the stand-around time? This is your home. You're the hostess. And it would be a nice gesture. So she says, fine. So we go down, and as soon as Gromyko sees her, he knows all about how influential she was. So he goes over. It's like nobody else is in the room. Rivets on her. And before long, he says to her, does your husband want peace? You know, Nancy could bristle. She says, of course my husband wants peace. And Gromyko says, well, then every night before he goes to sleep, a whisper in his ear, peace. So he's a little taller than Nancy, so she puts her hands on his shoulders. He pulls them down, so he has to bend his knee. And she said, I whispered in your ear, peace. I said, Nancy, you just won the Cold War. But that deployment, that was so strategic. That was the turning point. And it's always interesting to me to contrast that. That was a major show of strength. There were no shots fired. There's a big difference between the use of force and strength. That was an example of strength without the use of force. Nobody got killed or anything.
Among your many roles was involvement in labor and as a labor economist. we have a new administration, and part of the concern that brought this administration to power was about jobs and the workforce in the United States. So how do we address a changing workforce in the United States? What's needed to bring jobs back to middle America, to the folks who voted so strongly for our president? What would you do if you were advising this president about jobs?
Well, the first thing is to have the economy have a strong expansion. And if we can get reasonable tax reform, personal and corporate, and get this regulatory overreach that's been going on back a little, I think the economy will expand, and that will produce jobs and a sense of motion in the country. So I think that's the big ploy. But we have to remember that our country is a country of immigrants. I remember once Lee Kuan Yew, the fabled head of Singapore, was here, and he was a friend of mine. I said to him, "Harry, why are you here?" And he said, "Well, we have to loosen up in Singapore, and something's going on here that we have to understand. So I'm going to create a venture capital fund and try to be part of this and understand it." And I said, "Well, you're going to find when you go down Silicon Valley or here in San Francisco." He said, it's America, but there are people here from all over America. So that's what you're going to see." And he said, "I know that, but it could only happen in America." I heard President Reagan say once, "You can go to France, you'll never become a Frenchman. You can go to Japan, you'll never become Japanese. You can go to China, you'll never become Chinese," and so on around the world. But anyone can come from anywhere and be an American. So I think we have to keep that. Can I read something? Let me read something to you.
Please.
That President Reagan said on this subject. This is President Reagan. "Yes, the torch of Lady Liberty symbolizes our freedom and represents our heritage, the compact with our parents, our grandparents, and our ancestors. Other countries may seek to compete with us, but in one vital area, as a beacon of freedom and opportunity that draws the people of the world, no country on earth comes close. This, I believe, is one of the most important sources of America's greatness. We lead the world because, unique among nations, we draw our people, our strength, from every country and every corner of the world. And by doing so, we continuously renew and enrich our nation. While other countries cling to the stale past, here in America, we breathe life into dreams. We create the future, and the world follows us into tomorrow. Thanks to each wave of new arrivals to this land of opportunity, we're a nation forever young, forever bursting with energy and new ideas, and always on the cutting edge, always leading the world into the new frontier. This quality is vital to our future as a nation. If we ever closed the door to new Americans, our leadership in the world would soon be lost." That's Ronald Reagan.
That's a great strength of America. One of the audience members wants to know, what do you say to those who feel the U.S. is in decline on the world stage?
Well, the people have risen, and I don't think we have been projecting ourselves as we had before. So we need to change. After World War II, some gifted people with names like Acheson and Marshall and Truman looked back, and what did they see? They saw two world wars. They saw the first one was settled in rather vindictive terms, helped lead to the second. They saw 51 million people were killed in the Second World War. They saw the Holocaust. They saw the Great Depression. They saw the protectionism and currency manipulation that aggravated it. And they said to themselves, what a crummy world. And we're part of it, whether we like it or not. So they set out to build something better. And it wasn't America telling people what to do. It was leadership. There were 44 countries at Bretton Woods. But out of it came the currency stuff, the trade stuff, the World Bank, an effort to stabilize economically. When the Cold War came along, NATO was created, the doctrine of containment, which was a peaceful doctrine, I might say. And we followed through. And over time, and I was part of this, I could see, it was all basically kind of a nonpartisan effort. We passed the torch from one administration to another. And by the time the Cold War was over, there had been constructed, with a lot of leadership from the United States, a global security and economic commons. And everybody benefited from it, including us. That commons is falling apart. And we have a crummy world out there, a world awash in change. And we're part of it, whether we like it or not. It isn't as though we can pull back and whatever happens doesn't make any difference to us. It does. It makes a difference. So we need to be active. And that doesn't mean we're the world's policeman, but it means that we exercise leadership and stand for things that are good things, and we can do it. So I hope that we can do that. I was called, I haven't had contacts with the new administration, but somebody called me about it, and I said, well, when Ronald Reagan and I started in, we said, foreign policy starts in your neighborhood. If you have a strong neighborhood, then you have a base from which to work. If your neighborhood is unraveling, it's not good. So my first trip out of the country was to Canada. The traveling press said, what in the world are you doing going to Canada? You got China, you got the Cold War. And I said, Canada is our biggest trading partner by far. That's why. My second trip was to Mexico. But during our administration, by that time, Mexico considered itself part of Latin America. They didn't think of it, said North America. But we worked on it, and they had a new president called De La Madrid, who is the unsung hero of the Mexican change. And I remember one time he was up in Washington. In those days, the president had a yacht, and I got the yacht for an evening, and De La Madrid and I floated down the Potomac talking, and he's telling me about Mexico. And he says, you know, every time any business goes bankrupt in Mexico, the state takes it over. So we own beauty parlors, grocery stores, you name it, we own it. He says, it's impossible. I said, yeah, you've got to get rid of that. And then he says, our companies aren't competitive enough. And I said, well, why don't you bring them into GATT? Which he did. So he said, we subject them to international competition, and that'll be good for them. So he laid all that groundwork. And then Salinas and Pedro Aspe came in, and Mexico joined, in effect, the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, and NAFTA was created. NAFTA has been a gigantic success. People don't realize our imports from Mexico are 40% U.S. content, 40%. And from Canada, it's 25%. There's no relationship like this anywhere else in the world, nothing. And we have gradually formed a sense of North America with a lot of collaborative, good relations. The Three Amigos summits take place now. So why is it that we want to declare war on Mexico? Would you please answer me that question? It makes no sense whatever. And I might say there are more Mexicans going back today than there are coming. The fertility in Mexico is down to replacement level. The immigration problem comes from Central America. Why? And we've been having good collaborative relationships with Mexico to get control of it. But you have to ask, why? Because in Central America, it's become very murderous. Why is it that way? Drug gangs. People who want to get control and be the ones who are running the illegal drug trade into the United States. That's where the violence is coming from. And so, in a sense, the traffic in illegal drugs in the United States is providing the money and the guns for violence in Central America. Doesn't make sense. I remember way back in 1970, Pat, we were started in the Nixon administration on this notion that we don't want people to take drugs, so the idea is to prevent them from being here. And Pat Moynihan was kind of an unappointed drug czar. And we're riding up to Camp David, and I have a presentation to make, so I'm studying. And Pat's in a state of euphoria, and he interrupts me. He says, "Don't you realize we just had the biggest drug bug in history?" I said, "That's great." He said, "But you don't get it. There's 50 trillion tons of cocaine, and we've broken the French connection. This was in Marseille. Big deal." So there was kind of a silence. Then Pat says, "I suppose you think that as long as there is a big profitable demand for drugs in the United States, there will be a supply." I said to Moynihan, "There's hope for you." So we got to do something about the demand for drugs. And we did it with cigarettes, and it's worked well. It saved us. It's one of the biggest preventive health things we've ever done. We've got to do something like that in drugs. It's out of control.
Since we've started a bit on the current administration, there are obviously many, many questions about that. Some of the questions, given your wide experience across different cabinet offices and so on, are about how the government should be structured. Who should be members of the NSC, for example?
Well, it isn't a question of should. There's a piece of legislation that describes it. The members, I can remember when Colin Powell got the job of the so-called National Security Advisor. He came over to see me. I knew him well, in my office as Secretary of State. And he said, "George, I'm here sort of reporting in as a member of your staff." I said, "That's interesting." He said, "Yes, the National Security Council consists of the President, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense. That's it. The council has a staff. I'm the chairman of the staff." So I'm obviously working, the president's my most important client, but everybody, and if you got anything you want me to do, let me know. So that's the way it should work.
Turning to the State Department.
We got two good guys in there now, maybe three. Jim Mattis I know very well because he's been down at Stanford at the Hoover Institution for the last 2 or 3 years. And he is an outstanding human being. He's very able. He's thoughtful. He reads. He thinks. He's very direct. If you ask him his opinion, he tells you head on. You know exactly what he thinks. No puffery around it. So he's a very experienced guy. So he is first class. And the man they've just named as a security advisor, also, from all I know, Both of them have Hoover backgrounds, incidentally. So they're good. I don't know Mr. Tillerson, but if you've run a big organization like that, you know that it isn't all about me. It's about the organization, and the organization does things. And the State Department is a big organization, has embassies all over the world, and your big job is to make that work for you. And that you can do that if you work with it.
Do you expect him to be a strong Secretary of State from what you've seen?
I certainly hope so. I see no reason why he can't be.
Here's an interesting one. What would President Reagan advise President Trump in terms of demeanor?
I'm going to leave that one to you.
Let's turn to the Russians for a moment.
Let me just make one remark, though, on Reagan was thought of as a great communicator, and he knew how. And let me tell you two stories about it. One time he gave me the job of announcing and explaining a reasonable report in foreign policy decision he made. So I wrote the speech out very carefully, and I brought it over to him in one of our private meetings, and I said, "You asked me to do this, Mr. President. Would you mind taking a look at that to be sure it's what you want?" So he leafed through it, put it down. He said, "Perfect." There was kind of a dead silence. I said, "Of course, if I was doing it, I wouldn't do it this way." And then he said, "You've written this out to be read, which is fine. But when I give a speech, I give it to people who are in front of me or on the end of the TV camera. And then he picked up the speech and he flipped it open at random. He was a very good writer and a very good editor. And he edited around, he personalized it. In one place, he put a character, he put story. And I looked at it and I said, what's the story about? He said, well, that's the most important point on this page. And it's not enough to get into their head. You've got to get into their gut. And the way to get into their gut is to tell them a story that they can relate to. Then they'll really get it. So he had that sense of communication. Then on another occasion, I sat in on a lunch between President Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. And Margaret was going to make a speech to a joint session of Congress the following day. And she was going to use a teleprompter for the first time. So he was grilling her on it. And he found that she had a teleprompter that was shaped like this. He said, no, you don't want that because your eyes go back and forth. It should be like this. So he had to change the teleprompter. Then he said, when you look back and forth between one teleprompter, don't do it with your head. Turn your whole body back and forth. And then he said, you've got a speech that's written out, and you move the pages because of a note on the teleprompter. But two or three times during the speech, have a good quotation. And then you pick up the piece of paper and you read the quotation. And then you put it back down again and it seems like everything else that you're not reading. But, I mean, he thought a lot about it. And people said, well, he's a movie actor. Well, one of the things you learn as an actor is how you put something across. There's nothing wrong with that.
Okay, on to the Russians for a moment. What's the best strategy to address the recent Russian aggressiveness in Crimea, Ukraine, the Baltics, etc.?
Well, Russia is out to destroy a sense of the West, to destroy Europe, NATO. They flew an intermediate range missile recently, breaking the treaty that I helped negotiate. And for the same reason as before, namely, they want to use it to bite us from our friends and allies. So they moved into the Middle East. They had an agreement. And Bill Perry, who you and I both know very well, wonderful guy, he negotiated a treaty involving Russia, Ukraine, Britain, and ourselves, that we would respect the borders of Ukraine when Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. They don't even pay any attention to that. So they're bad news. And the way to handle them is to stand up to what they're doing. And I'm glad to see troops going into the Baltics. That's a good move. We've got to be sure we mean it. We're not just playing games here.
If you pick up the rifle, make sure you are willing to use it.
And I think we should develop an energy initiative for the Baltic states and Poland. And we can do it. We can get up enough energy to take away the Russian monopoly of oil and gas, which they use. They're perfectly willing to cut off your gas supplies in the middle of winter and let you freeze to death. So we need to get a hold of that and build our bargaining power. And then we need to revive Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Liberty, and Radio Europe, because we're not projecting a message, and we should project it, including to the Russians. What do we think about all this? And then I think we have to be ready, when the worm turns, to reach out, because they're playing a very weak hand. Playing it aggressively, but it's a weak hand. Their demographics are terrible. Fertility is very low. Their longevity is not much. They're heavily dependent on oil and gas, and those prices have collapsed. So they're in trouble. And the last thing in the world we want is a Russia in chaos. So we've got to help it not get to that. But in the meantime, the way to bring them in is to stand up and show that we really mean it.
So there's a lot of speculation about their intention and activities to disrupt the U.S. election. Do you support a bipartisan commission to investigate their involvement in the 2016 U.S. election?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing to know what they did and how they did it. But we don't want to build them up too much. It's like they're Superman. They can interfere in anybody's election and elect whoever they want. Nonsense. Let's not build them up.
You've been quite outspoken about the environment and climate change. How did you come to take that position of concern about climate change? I know you were very involved with Governor Schwarzenegger and his agenda to mitigate California's climate change contribution to carbon emissions and so on. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I had a long history on the subject that I won't go into, except that one, the most recent piece of it was in the mid-80s. There was a lot of really good scientists thought the ozone layer was depleting. And even the ones who doubted it agreed that if it happened, it would be a catastrophe. So instead of doing what you do now when somebody opposes you, you vilify them and try to drive them away, Ronald Reagan did the opposite. He put his arm around the people who disagree and said, well, you disagree, we respect it. But you do agree if it happens, it's a catastrophe. So let's take out an insurance policy. That didn't get him with us, but it got him off our back. And so on came something called the Montreal Protocol, which worked. And in retrospect, I think it's pretty clear. Everybody says the ozone layer was depleting, and so the people who were worried were right, and the Montreal Protocol came along just in time. So that's a good concept, insurance policy. Now, I think you take it in steps. First of all, is the Earth getting warmer? I think the answer to that question is unequivocally yes. The science is compelling, I think, but if you don't like the science, use your powers of observation. There's a new ocean being created in the Arctic, and the sea ice is melting faster and faster. The big ice sheet over Greenland, which is gigantic, is melting very fast. In the West Antarctica, the big sheaves of ice are coming into the warmer water. So the evidence is there. Just look at it. It's getting warmer. Why? I think the carbon is the main culprit. But there are people who doubt it, so I say, well, let's do it the Reagan way. Let's take out an insurance policy, because if the climate does keep warming, it's going to be a catastrophe. So we ought to get at it that way. And here are the things we should do. First of all, we should have a good, sustainable program of energy R&D. Finally, something like that has happened in the last 6 or 8 years. And the amount of federal money is so small you can almost can't find it in the rounding error. But I chair the MIT Advisory Committee, and the same with Stanford. So I know what's going on. And these guys are making a huge, and I might say both those places, the private money is 3-to-1 government money. But they're making huge progress. In solar and wind, the costs are way down. Batteries are better and better, and they're going to continue to get better. Chevy now has a car out that'll go almost 250 miles between charges, so electric cars are here, and they're going to get better. Batteries are going to be better. And I read that Tesla has recently established a multi-battery setup that gives you large-scale storage of electricity. And I think people are going to figure out how to do that in a more efficient way. But at any rate, that takes the intermittency problem away from solar and wind, because the electricity goes into the battery when it's created and goes out when it's needed. So you got that. So let's do that. And then I advocate, and we had a big rollout of this about a week or so ago in Washington, a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And I say, hoping to appeal to Republicans, say, look, if you don't like all this EPA telling you do this, don't do that, and so on, get rid of it all and put a price out there. And put the price high enough so you level the playing field. And the forms of energy that produce carbon have to carry that cost in competition with others. And make it revenue neutral so there's no fiscal drag connected with it. And it's not going to be used for some government program. And we could have it so that every 3 or 4 months you get a check, your carbon dividend. Not bad. You like it. Say it's a couple of grand. Pretty nice. And for somebody with a low income, that's a lot of money for a billionaire. So it's progressive in its effect. So I think we wrote this out. We have a group of people working on it. And Jim Baker read out our program at the National Press Club. And then he was invited over to the White House and met with Cohen, the economic person. And he said that various people dropped in, so at least we've got it in play. So that's the program.
And I just wanted to let you know there's someone here from the Citizens Climate Lobby who calls the carbon tax plan you announced thrilling.
Calls me what?
Calls the carbon tax plan you announced thrilling. Thrilling. So a lot of support for that.
Well, I hope so. But it was interesting and discouraging to me. In Washington State, they had a vote in the last election for a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And all the environmentalists opposed it because they wanted the money. Mm. Principle down the drain, just money.
So,
got to get over that.
So here's a story that I know about you, which most people probably don't, because you and my husband and I all drove the same early-stage electric cars called the EV1. And you told me that you served on the General Motors board, and you had a certain role in causing General Motors to make that car.
Well, I was on the board for a little while. And GM would always have one of their meetings at their proving grounds. So it was fun. You'd drive their cars, you'd drive competitors' cars. And they always had an electric car there, usually a van. So I, back in the boardrooms, I made a sort of pest out of myself. When do we produce this? And they said, well, it doesn't cost. Well, get one out there and then start improving it. So I had left the board for a while, and all of a sudden they got in touch with me, and they said, you should be pushing us all the time on an electric car. Would you like to drive this EV1. So I said, absolutely, bring it on. So they did. And when I was courting Charlotte, I had it and she was interested, so I let her drive it. Did the job for me.
I should say that your book is dedicated to your wife, Charlotte Schultz, who's here with us tonight, who's the chief of protocol for the city of San Francisco and a member of the Commonwealth Club board. The wonderful Charlotte Schultz. So there are some further questions about the Trump administration. And you're a lifelong Republican. And there are a number of questions about how you approach this administration as a lifelong Republican. One of them is Republicans say we have to give the president a chance. The writer says, I find that difficult given his first few weeks. Do you believe that we should give him a chance?
Of course.
Say more about that.
And you want the president to be successful. If the president's successful, we're all successful. I didn't vote for Barack Obama, but I supported him in a lot of ways because you want him to be successful if he's going to be the president. So, yes.
There's towards the end of your book, there's a rather grim section entitled, It Can All Slip Away. And it has to do with the continuing role of nuclear weapons in the world and the spread of nuclear weapons. You've been an advocate for a world free of nuclear weapons. Are we closer or farther away from that goal today than we were a few years ago when you and Bill Perry and Sam Nunn and Henry Kissinger began writing and speaking about that?
Well, I've been working on the nuclear weapons issue for a long time. And President Reagan thought nuclear weapons were immoral. He said, what's so good about keeping the peace by an ability to wipe each other out, which is what would happen? You drop a modern nuclear weapon on the Bay Area, it incinerates the Bay Area, it's gone. The power of these things, we've sort of forgotten. But we worked on them, and they're now in the world about a third the number of nuclear weapons as there were at the time of Reykjavik. So we made a lot of progress. But the atmosphere has changed, and people aren't as concerned as they ought to be. And I remember after the Chernobyl accident. Remember the difficult one. I was fascinated to find in the first meeting I had with Gorbachev after that accident, I found he'd asked the same question I had, namely, okay, we see the damage at Chernobyl. What would it have been like if that nuclear weapon had been dropped there? Answer, far more destruction. So you get it into your gut about these things. And people have forgotten that, and we somehow have to get people back to it, and I hope it doesn't have to happen as a result of a nuclear weapon going off. But Bill Perry has been working on this, and I have. One of the things that people need to realize is that if a nuclear weapon hits somewhere, that's not the only place that's affected. If we have a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan, for example, it's a global event. It affects the entire atmosphere. So everybody, just the places that have the animosity that get hit, everybody gets hit. So we've got to get back to being aware of the difficulty that they're posed by nuclear weapons, and then start doing something. Right now there's proliferation. And the more people have nuclear weapons, the more fissile material there is. And it's not apparently very difficult to make a weapon once you have the fissile material. So that's bad to have more and more of that around. So present situation is very dangerous, in my opinion. The two things that really can wreck our world are, number one, nuclear weapons, number two, climate change. Those are the two big issues of a global sort that we have to be after.
And on nuclear weapons, what should be done now, and what should be undone or not undone? What about the Iran agreement? Should we keep that in place? Should we try to improve it? What else should be done dealing with North Korea?
Well, the Iran agreement, Iran has already gotten what they want, which is the lifting of sanctions. So if you killed it, all you do is take any burden off them to do the things they promised to do with nuclear weapons. So I didn't really like the agreement, but it's done. It's a done deal. So let's get what we can out of it. I might say the Reagan playbook on how we approach a problem is you start out by letting people be clear that you mean what you say and you can accomplish what you set out to accomplish. Then you're realistic. Then you're strong. Then you figure out what your agenda is. You don't pay attention to what the other guy thinks his agenda is, or you'll be negotiating with yourself. Then you engage. In the case of Iran, it's the world's leading supporter of terrorism. They're trying to get a ballistic missile. Why? They managed to keep control of their country. I think they're the largest executioner of political prisoners in the world. And then they're trying to get a nuclear weapon. I believe we should have put the whole thing on the agenda, because right now Iran has got all this additional money and they're raising hell. And it's a big problem. So North Korea. Henry Kissinger and I, and some other, Bill Perry is involved, Sam Nunn, Four Horsemen. We have a little track, too, with China. And they have good people there.
Track two meaning back-channel discussions outside of government.
You know, track one is government to government. Track two is people who have been in government and presumably have some access to the people in government. They don't speak for the government. But in this case, this track two was started, and the administration was made absolutely aware of it, and they brief us before we go, and we brief them when we come back, and we are careful not to do anything outside. But we do learn. And the Chinese side very authoritatively came to Henry and I, and they said, we want to create a nuclear weapons-free Korean peninsula. And we want to work with you on it. But in order to be effective, it has to be quiet. Can't have everything in public. Got to do it quietly or we can't manage it. So we told that to Secretary Kerry. And Then I see a picture of him leaving Beijing announcing, we're going to work with China on North Korea. I said, oh, my God, that's not the way to do it. You don't. It's too much politicizing of things. So we got to be quiet, and somehow we can get back to that. But I think China is absolutely the key to getting anywhere with North Korea.
How important has crossing political lines and party lines been to how important has crossing party lines been to your success in all of these different roles?
Well, I started in the Eisenhower administration. Everybody liked Ike. It was not a problem. I was in the Nixon administration. I did work for Kennedy. I did work for Johnson. And then Reagan, of course. But always you worked, if you could get a subject not bipartisan but nonpartisan, get into the nonpartisan category, then you really get someplace. Our work on arms control with the Soviets was basically nonpartisan. Our 1986 Tax Act, which was originally proposed by President Reagan, passed the Senate 97-3. And it was introduced in the House by Dick Gephardt, who was the Democratic leader, and Bill Bradley had the laboring oar in the Senate. And somebody asked Reagan after it passed, 97-3, if it bothered him that two Democrats introduced this legislation. He said, it passed, didn't it?
Whatever it takes.
So somehow we've got to get back to that. And I think the key is somehow restoring trust. Trust is the coin of the realm. And can you work off the record and trust each other and develop something that we can get behind? The 1986 Tax Act was a very complicated piece of legislation in the tax business. If you get something like that that passes 97-3, you know some people did some good, quiet work on the subject.
You wrote your thesis at Princeton on the men's shoe industry.
No, that was my PhD thesis at MIT.
At MIT. Would you tell us a little bit about what you learned from the men's shoe industry?
Well, it's a very competitive industry. And there was a town called Brockton, it's still there, not too far from Cambridge. And it was then a center of high-priced quality shoes. So I had a broad thesis, but that was a kind of case study. And I went down there, and I had these statistics, and the statistics showed that here comes the Depression in the 1930s, and somehow the wages didn't seem to change. And I thought, isn't that odd? And economists spin theories of that try to explain something like that. And I was starting to think about things like that. And I'd go down to Brockton, and I'd ask the management people, I'd ask the union people, and they'd all say, well, that's the grade system. And finally it dawned on me that they had piecework. And what you got paid for a piece of work on a shoe changed when the price of the shoe changed. So their piecework piece rate never changed, but the quality of the shoes, obviously, in the Depression became less. So they did cut wages, but they did it in a way that nobody noticed it. So I come away saying, you know, people are smarter than you think they are. They figure out how to get something done without you knowing it. And they did it that way, I think, in part because they knew if they cut their wages, everybody else would too, and they wouldn't have gained anything in the competition. But I had another lesson. In my bachelor's thesis at Princeton, I studied the agricultural program of the TVA. And they had a program of giving fertilizer to farmers in demonstration areas trying to get conservation of the land and so on. So I had a fellowship, and I went to Washington. I collected statistics. I went to Knoxville, and I collected statistics. And then somehow or other, I fell into luck. And I went to what was called a demonstration area, and I was lucky enough to be put up by a couple at their home for 2 weeks. And these were people who had no education, but I quickly could see they were very smart. And they knew exactly what the government wanted to hear. And they also were absolutely dead honest. So after they, and I learned how to interview them. The way you interview them, you sit on the porch and rock and you don't say anything. And you let them start a conversation. Then you can have a conversation. But after a while, they had some confidence in me, so they asked me to help them fill out the forms. As I said, I could see they knew what the government wanted to hear, but they weren't going to put anything down that was false. But everything got slanted. So I get back to Princeton, and I'm looking at my statistics, and all of a sudden it dawns on me. These numbers are just compilations of the kind of forms that I helped fill out. So they've got biases in them. So whenever I look at a number these days, I say, where did it come from? And who sliced it up? And you look at polls, you look at all kinds of numbers, and you got to ask yourself, where did they come from? That was a good lesson.
So, Mr. Schultz, if I count the numbers right, you are 96?
Well, you're a gifted counter.
You've had an amazing life, an amazing career. You've worked on labor issues, desegregation, diplomacy, business, nuclear disarmament. What's your agenda going forward? What's left?
Well, Charlotte and I have 5 great-grandchildren. And Christmas time we saw them. And they don't walk anywhere. They run. They're curious about everything. And it's so much fun to watch them. But you can't help say to yourself, what kind of a world are they going to inherit? And is there anything I can do to make it better? So that's my motivation. That's what I want to do, make it better for them.
Thank you for making it better for all of us for so many, many decades. Thank you for all you've done and contributed to this world. Thank you on behalf of the Commonwealth Club and our audience for being with us this evening. This has been former Secretary of State, Labor, and Treasury, the very honorable George Schultz. We thank our audiences here on the Internet. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
That's a fair favorite.